We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. And we're happy, once again, to have here on the show Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. And for a long time now, he's been here on a regular basis. It's always on a Monday to talk about home maintenance. So here's the idea. You got some problem. You need some advice on dealing with it. You give us a call, and he'll see if he can help you out. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You may also email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. Hey, thanks very much.
Good morning, David.
We have someone ready to go. We will not make them wait a moment longer. We'll go here to Champaign, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
Actually, I'm calling about a house which is not my own. This house looks like it hasn't been painted in about 20 years, and it's at this point it has siding falling off of it, exposing what might be part of the house to the entry of all kinds of rodents. Now, as it happens, this house is not occupied by people, but it is in use. The house I'm referring to is on First Street, and it's several hundred yards south of the intersection to First and Windsor. Do you know what house I'm talking about by any chance?
Not right off the top of my head, no.
How
I've
about
got an
your
idea.
Host? Does he know?
No.
Okay, well, this house actually houses the transmitter that is carrying our voices as we speak.
Okay. Yeah, oh. I know about which house it is.
Okay, and it is in really bad shape looking at it from the outside, and I have a feeling that if it continues this way, one of these days a squirrel is going to get in there and is going to jump across the two poles of the transmitter, and then your signal is going to be out for several hours at least while you go down there and fix it.
Well, I guess you'll have to take that up with our engineering staff. I'm afraid that's a little outside of my area of responsibility.
Well, that's probably true, but the house part of it, I think, is well within the expertise of your guest.
Yeah.
And if he wants to really be entertained and see a lot of really interesting housing problems, he just ought to go down there and take a look at it.
Well, of course, I don't have to go that far to see it. There's several houses in Champaign-Urbana that have similar problems, yes.
Okay.
A lack of, or what we call deferred maintenance.
Yeah, right. Long deferred maintenance. So, okay, I just thought I'd pass that little item on to you.
All right, thank you for calling in.
Let's go on to Lafayette, Indiana. This is line four. Hello.
Hello. It's the season for weather stripping, and can I use regular packing tape to weather strip over a porch door that I won't open until spring?
You could put a packing tape on. The most packing tapes, however, as soon as they age a little bit, particularly like a clear cellophane packing tape,
mm-hmm.
The glue starts to deteriorate, and either the packing tape comes loose, or when you go to pull it off, it leaves the glue residue behind, so it's pretty sticky and kind of difficult to clean up afterwards. They do make some insulation tapes that are very similar to the packing tape that have a little bit different type of adhesive that doesn't leave the residue when you go to remove it. They recommend it for anything from cracked windows if you want to try and keep some air out to gaps such as what you're referring to.
Well, this is the varnished wood on French doors.
If it's a varnished wood, I don't know that I'd want to put any adhesive that's got a good seal like a packing tape, because it's very likely to pull the finish back off the wood. If it's oiled or something, that might be a different story. But if it's got a layer of varnish on it, or even a coating of paint, you may have problems with the packing tape. The adhesive on packing tape is pretty good stuff.
Yes, it is. I wondered about it, stripping the paint.
Yeah, right. And it very easily could be a problem. And like I say, they do make an insulation tape, which is, it looks similar to a packing tape, you know, 1.5 inch or 2 inch wide clear tape, and it can be used for purposes like that. The adhesive doesn't set up quite as like a packing tape does. It stays more pliable, so it's a little easier to remove after the end of the season.
Okay.
Now, if you leave it on 3 or 4 years, it's still going to dry out and stick and be a problem. But if you just use it for one season, it works pretty well.
So just regular insulating tape.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other question is, we keep hearing about short circuits starting fires in a building, but why or how does that happen? Wouldn't it just knock out the fuse or breaker and stop the current?
If you have a direct short, yes, you can. Should trip off a breaker, depending on how much current is being drawn. Circuit breakers are rated for a certain amount of electrical current. The current is basically the maximum amount a wire can carry before the wire starts getting warm. You can get an arc or a spark without having a high current, depending on what you're arcing to. If you're going straight from a hot wire to a neutral wire, yes, you're going to trip the circuit breaker. But if you're going from a hot wire to something that is partially grounded, a plumbing fixture or something like that may not have a good ground, you may not get a full voltage or a full current draw enough to drop that circuit breaker out. Now, they do make an arc fault circuit interrupter. The arc fault circuit interrupters are newer to the electric code. I want to say they came out in about 04, 05. Started being mandated, I believe, in 07 for all bedroom outlets. The primary reason that I found was for electric blankets. If you had a poor wire in an electric blanket, you could get a couple of arcs which could catch the blanket on fire. So they're designed where they measure they check the circuit for an arc. If they decide that there has been a spark of some sort, it will go ahead and trip the breaker. If you've ever plugged in your vacuum cleaner or your shop vac into an outlet and you had the unit on when you go to plug it in, you notice a little spark at the outlet when you first plugged it in. It's not enough to trick the breaker, but it is enough to create a fire hazard.
We're often warned to plug in the wall first and then the delicate electrodes, then afterward on the delicate electrodes on the device.
Right. So, yes, you can have arcing without tripping a circuit breaker. A short circuit, which would would indicate a direct neutral to hot connection, will trip off a circuit breaker. But there are several different things you can short to that are not necessarily well-grounded, such as yourself, which is why we have the GFCI circuits in bathrooms and any place where there's water. But, that's a good question.
By the way, what Can an electrical shock traverse right up the stream of water from a fireman's hose?
If you've got water, it does conduct electricity. So, yes, I would say that is a possibility.
So I suppose they try to turn it off.
Most of the time before they go into a building or start wetting it down, they make sure that the utilities are off, yes.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks
for
calling.
Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. This is our monthly show on home maintenance. Scott Spies is the guest from the Spies Home Inspection Service.
I did notice yesterday, watching a little late-night television with the Mythbusters, and the Mythbusters were trying to debunk the kite and the key Benjamin Franklin experiment way back when. I unfortunately was not allowed to be able to stick around for watching the actual show to find out whether or not they did anything with it. But
so
I thought
they were trying to figure out if you actually did that, you had the kite and the key, would lightning strike the key and then...
Would lightning strike the kite, be able to travel down the wet rope or wet string and down to the key and give enough of a shock? So it was something on Mythbusters that I thought was kind of interesting, which I was unfortunately not able to find the conclusion to.
Myself, around my house, anytime something has to do with electricity, I call an electrician. I don't mess around with it. Let's go to line number two in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. I have a question about roofing. We need to replace ours, and I am wondering what is your opinion about putting shingles over the existing three-tap, if it's just one layer, or what would you recommend, replacing totally everything or just putting over? There's substantial savings, obviously.
Yes, there is, particularly in labor. The removal of the old shingles is very labor-intensive and expensive, hauling them away with a large carry-all-type dumpster. If there is one layer of shingles, then I see no problem with going over with a second layer, provided that the existing layer is not in such condition that the shingle tabs are excessively curled, where they would prevent the new shingles from laying flat. Excessive moss and mildew growth, something like that, that we could bury with the new shingles and actually promote additional growth because they don't want to dry out. So if the shingles are in normal, worn condition, yes, a second layer is acceptable. Now, a third layer is not recommended and against building codes in most areas, in that the roof framing for most of our homes is not rated for the weight load of three layers of shingles plus a snow load or a wind load. So two layers of roofing is recommended. Generally, an asphalt shingle is good for about 20 years of life, 20 to 22 years of life. As a second layer, it may not quite go 20, 22 years. It may take a couple years off of it to where you get 18 to 20 years out of it. Yes, you lose a couple years by going with a second layer, but the cost savings, as you indicated, are significant enough to where I think that, it would still make sense to put a second layer over.
Okay, thank you very much. Right.
Very good. To Bloomington, Illinois, this is the next person here, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I have a gas fireplace that we rarely use. I've heard about these inflatable balloons that you put up in the chimney flue to keep the heat in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Are those something readily available, or are they recommended?
You'd probably want to check with one of the chimney shops or do some research, quick research on the internet. Something of that style, you can use something that's inflatable that you could put up there. You could put in a piece of fiberglass bat wrapped in a plastic bag so that you can pull it back out easily. There's any number of different ways where you can block the flue off if you're not going to use it. Now, if you've got a gas fireplace, you want to make sure that you turn the gas valve off to the fireplace prior to doing so. The main gas, not just the one at the burner, because if there's any leakage past any of the valves, we don't want to be able to collect in that fireplace opening and not be able to vent to the outside. A gas fireplace actually should have a hole or gap in the damper to allow a constant draft. So if there is a slight gas leak or somebody leaves a pilot light on, it does have a way of venting. So if you're going to block off the flue to that, you need to make sure that you make the main gas to the fireplace is disconnected or shut off.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And to another caller. This is Champagne, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is an existing house that they're trying to remodel. And up in what was the attic space, now they want to turn that into living space. And the rafters were actually 4 inches. Now, they want the ceiling to follow the rafter like a cathedral, but they need to insulate this now, and I'm just wondering if there's a way. See, there's only we'll call it a 2x4, but if you added 10 inches of insulation, or maybe you'd even recommend more, you need to extend the thickness of the rafter. And I was just wondering if there are plastic spacers or what the best way to do would be to add the dimension to carry a 10-inch bat, plus you'd need a couple of inches of ventilation next to the roof surface, my research shows. So do you have an idea of how you could essentially make the rafter thicker so you could carry 10 inches of ventilation without literally putting another 2x6 at every one of those rafter points?
They don't make any spacers that I'm aware of for that type of purpose. And what you're finding out is actually correct, that you do need to fur out the drywall far enough to where you can get an adequate amount of insulation. Of course, the more we're trying to save energy, the more that adequate amount becomes. And it used to be when we could put 3 inches in there, we might be able to get away with it. But now where they're recommending a minimum of 10 to 12 inches, an attic conversion like that is very difficult to do because of how much insulation we have to have. And as you pointed out, we still need to maintain some type of ventilation between the insulation and the roof sheathing.
Roof surface.
To make sure that we don't get moisture, condensation, mold, and mildew problems between the insulation and the sheathing.
But wouldn't it just be, I wanted to add a lot of weight, and it's useless structure to put another 2x6 where every rafter is a 2x4. I'm just hoping you had some idea that would give us the thickness we need to staple insulation in there and still be able to finish it out with gypsum board.
Well, what you could do is add one every other rafter, since I'm going to assume your rafters are probably on 24-inch centers. You could go every 4 foot with your 2x6 to space it out, or 2x8 to space it out, and then put purlins or nailing furring strips going horizontally instead of vertically, and install your drywall that direction.
And I see.
So that you've got a place, you've got a smaller diameter lumber. Instead of putting in a 2x6, you can run a bunch of 1x2s or 2x2s across the front face
nailers.
Of it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. That's a good idea. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Thank you. On again to Champagne, another Champagne caller. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a house that was built in 1948, and we currently don't have any problems that I know of with our main drain line, but we're considering replacing some of the toilets that are worn and cracked and real water hogs with some newer low-flow toilets. And I had someone suggest that it would be a good idea to have someone look at the main drain line with the camera first. Is there anything about the new low-flow toilets that's going to give me trouble with the drain lines?
Not that I've heard of. The low-flow toilets are a good way of saving some water usage. Most of them are down under a gallon per flush these days. To the best of my knowledge, there is no problem with connecting them to the old your house being in 1948 was going to have a cast iron drain system.
Yes.
And cast iron, unless you've got a bad section of cast iron drain line is quite durable with a life expectancy of 100 years or so. So I wouldn't expect to find any issues with the cast iron drain.
Okay, and there's no routine maintenance. I shouldn't have the main drain line, rooted out routinely or anything like that, as long as it seems to be working fine.
As long as it seems to be working fine, the low flow does tend to provide a little bit less water to help flush things, so hopefully the pipes don't have too steep of an incline. We found that if the steep incline on a drain line, the water tends to run away, leaving some of the solids behind, so they tend to block a little bit more easily. But most of the time in a house that was properly constructed, and if you haven't had problems since 1948, I would say the drain lines were probably pretty well angled. The cast iron should not be an issue.
Okay, real good. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. This is something that I think more and more people are thinking about, replacing older toilets, because it's really remarkable that you can get about a third or a quarter reduction in your water use by going to a new toilet that's designed to use, 2 gallons of a flush, or maybe there are some that, as you say, that use even less.
Yeah, they are getting much more water conservation minded as far as the toilets go. We are kind of spoiled with having a nice clean odor in the house, so a toilet is a necessity. But if we can use less water to maintain the same cleanliness, it will of course save the environment and water all sorts of different directions. The thing I would recommend if you're going to look for low-flow toilets is probably not be looking at the least expensive models. They tend to not work quite as well. The other ones are usually a little more expensive for a good reason. Mm-hmm. So I would try and stay away from the real low-end stuff. The ones that look like too good a deal to be true probably are. They may not be as convenient as you think they might be.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go back to the phones here. McLean County up next, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I have a question, and I hope you can help me. I have tinnitus, which means I always have noise in my head. So when I turn the water faucets on, almost all of them have those aerators,
mm-hmm.
and they create so much extra noise. And I try to take them out. Well, of course, you take them out, the water kind of goes haywire all over the place, and it's still noisy. Is there any way to cut down on the noise of the water coming into the faucet or out of the faucet?
Wow. I don't think I've ever been asked that question.
Hmm.
Not quite sure what is creating the noise. I mean, yes, there is some additional noise. Reducing the water pressure, in other words, not opening up as wide, will help reduce some of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that there are ways to install pressure regulators to where you could actually lower the pressure from the main water supply into the house so that when you turn it on at full volume, it is not quite coming out at, I know Champaign Urbana, we have 55 to 58 pounds of pressure, whereas most country wells, rural areas can get by with 30, 35 pounds of pressure. 45 is always nice, but you can get away with a little bit less water pressure. So that might be a thought of some type of pressure regulating system to where the your volume is still fairly high, but you don't have as much pressure, which is what's going to be creating the rush or the roar noise that I think you're hearing.
Okay, because I've been to a couple places. Like, I think Menards in Bloomington or Lowe's, one of the two, and then actually one in Peoria where I go to, they have these really long, like what I think called swan hook, a neck type water faucets.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to have, like, they have water running like a solid water. There's no air added to it, and they don't have the noise problem. So I do understand the pressure does, because you're right, if you have full force, it's more noise if you cut it down. But because there's aerator and because something else, it makes noise. Is there any? Okay. Well, maybe, you know, I'll let you think about that. I'll call you back in a few months. Maybe you can come up with something else for me.
All right.
It would really help because I know it really does bother me because, like, the noise is so much and sometimes it's really loud and it's really high pitch. So, but anyway, I will talk to my husband and see if we can adjust that at my house.
And you might try one or two of the restriction type aerators that are designed to, again, reduce water flow for saving energy.
Okay.
They may actually change the tone or the pitch of the water coming out.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So those things that are on the faucets, that actually is their function. They're actually supposed to restrict the water flow so that you end up using less water?
Well, what it is, the aerator is designed to spread the water out, give it a little bit more control so that it comes out in one direction. You can use it at a lower volume and still get some unilateral direction, so it's not just spraying everywhere. If you take the aerator out, the faucets generally are designed to just kind of spread every place.
Mm-hmm.
With the aerator in, you get a better washing, you get a better control over it. They do make an O-ring or a washer that goes in behind there. Some of them have a smaller diameter so that we reduce the actual amount of flow through the unit so that it does save water. And then the aerator, of course, makes it appear that you're getting the same amount of water.
Yeah. And those things do have little screens in there, so probably every once in a while it's worth unscrewing that, taking that off, because any little bits of debris, they're going to collect in the backside of the screen.
I will have to admit that if in Champaign Urbana, if we have the water, local city water, most of us are spoiled and have no clue how to take it apart and do anything with that screen. If you get any place outside of here where we don't have our super high quality water that we are provided here in the area, they all know about removing screens. It's particularly getting into rural areas, we get a lot of sand filters and such.
Yeah.
And yeah, you end up pulling those screens out every couple of weeks and taking them out. It does happen a little bit here in town, but for the most part, Champaign-Urbana is pretty well spoiled, and people don't even think about removing the aerator screens.
Right. Scott Spies is our guest from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on the program once a month, always on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next in line is Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
About 3 weeks ago, we ran into a situation at our home where all of a sudden it just seemed like our water pressure has just declined. And it's been this way for about 3 weeks. We've got no discernible leaks or anything that we can find. Water bill hasn't really changed, but we just don't have the pressure that we used to have. And one of the first things we noticed, the way that our house was done, we're one of the fortunate people that you could be in the shower and somebody else could flush a toilet and it wouldn't impact the water flow at all. Now it impacts it greatly. And if you turn on water anywhere in the house and try, you know, say if you're doing laundry and you try to turn on the water in the bathroom sink, the pressure really is diminished. And do you have any idea what could have caused this? I mean, this was just like one day it was fine and the next day it wasn't.
Are we on Champaign Urbana City Water, or are we on well water?
No, I live in Mattoon. I live north of Mattoon. I'm on Mattoon City Water.
Okay. Do you run a filter system on it?
No.
Okay. Because that quite often is you're not actually a pressure problem. My guess is if you were to put a pressure gauge onto an outdoor faucet and turn the faucet on, you'd find that your pressure is still fairly high. What you're describing is a flow restriction. As soon as you turn the water faucet on, the pressure drops because there is not enough water coming from the city pipe to refill the line. So you end up with a low flow, not necessarily a low pressure. Like I say, if I were to screw a gauge on the outdoor faucet, my guess is it's still going to come up at a 50 or 55 pounds, which is what they run down there. But somewhere we've got a restriction, a valve that's only partially shut. You check, make sure your water mains have not been opened and then closed. It could have been that we got a piece of debris in either the water meter or one of the water lines someplace. Basically, you're looking for a restriction. I did run into a case up toward Chicago where he had the same type of problem, and it turned out that the valve, they had turned off the water for the house for some plumbing work. When they opened it back up, the valve itself, the unit broke to where it only opened about a quarter of the way. And you go, if you open a valve on the upstairs faucet while somebody had one open downstairs, no water would come out upstairs. It would all come out downstairs. But it turned out to be the main shutoff valve was not opening fully, so they were not getting a full flow. But it sounds to me like we have more of a flow problem than a pressure problem. So somewhere you've got a restriction. Check and see, turn a faucet on in the house and then go out and see if you've got full pressure at, say, an outdoor faucet. Start close to the water meter and work your way out. If there's less of a problem towards the water meter, that means that probably the blockage is somewhere else in the house. How old is the house?
About 40 years.
Okay, so it should have copper water lines?
Yeah, they're copper as far as I know.
Okay. Because this is also something that we run into problems with steel water lines is we get a little bit of rust and corrosion, and some of that breaks loose and can actually restrict things. But if the house is that new, the copper water lines, very rarely do we get a restriction like that. Has for any reason the water been shut off at the house, just turned one of the water mains on and off at some point in time?
I haven't had a reason to do that, but I think we had a day where the city was doing some work and had to lower the water pressure for a while, not enough that we had a boil order. But also, we have, and I don't know if you're right, the house is 40 years old, 4-0. But one of the things we have is we have incredibly hard water. We've got a lot of minerals in our water, and so to have to, clean out aerators, that's something that, I have to change out every so often because the we just get mineral deposits. So I don't know. It could be a deposit that's come loose. And
are you running a softener?
No.
You're not running a water softener?
No, not at all.
Okay. That's something the water softener has some smaller lines that could actually restrict flow. I was just looking for other possibilities.
Right.
Kind of visualizing your house over the radio is kind of hard to do.
It's a one-story ranch house, and, with the one line coming in from the water main. I have one outdoor faucet, and, now that the weather's turned, I don't need to use it very much, so I don't know how it's impacted.
Like I say, it sounds to me... Yeah, it sounds to me like a flow problem. You can purchase a pressure gauge that will screw onto a standard three-quarter pipe for like an outdoor faucet that you could then turn the faucet on, and it basically will give you an idea of what the pressure is available to the house. Then turn another faucet on and see how much it drops, and that would indicate that, yes, we do have a blockage problem. If you end up with a flow problem that you can't trace back, or if you trace it as close to the water meter as possible and find out that it must be someplace else, then I would probably be checking with the city and say, hey, look, you guys played with it. Now I have a problem. You need to trace it back as far as the water meter. You're responsible for everything from probably the street to the house, but if you don't have a good flow at the water meter, then it's likely their responsibility to figure out where it could be a problem that they have out in a main someplace.
All righty. right. Well, thank you very much for your help. That's a lot of good advice.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go on here. Champagne is up next, and that's line number two. Hello.
Hello, Scott. I'm hoping you can solve a long marital conflict. I have about a 20-year-old house in Champaign, and we have fireplace on the first floor. About 30 foot away from the fireplace is the thermostat for the central heating and air. And I love having a fire going in the evening, but my wife is convinced that whenever we run the fireplace, it affects the temperature that's being read by the thermostat. And as a result, the upper floors of the house are cooler because the heater is not coming on as much.
Okay, I can agree with that.
Okay, and I just lost that one.
Yeah, that will happen. What will happen is you end up with a locally warmed room, and the thermostat will think that the house is plenty warm, so it's not circulating. However, there is this little switch on your thermostat called the fan control switch. It has two positions. One is on and one is auto. In auto, it comes on anytime the furnace fan is blowing or furnace burner is running. And on, it runs all the time. So when you have your fireplace on, if you were to turn the fan switch to the on position, it will circulate air and take the warm air that is in your living room and help distribute it through the rest of the room. So therefore, it will keep the rest of the house equally warm. So what I would recommend is rather than moving the thermostat, just when you're using the fireplace, go ahead and turn the fan switch to the on position on your furnace and let it circulate that heat not only from the fireplace, but all the way upstairs.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We have the same problem in our house. We have a little wood stove in our living room, and the thermostat's right there. And the wood stove, it's very nice, puts out a lot of heat, but it heats the living room, so it's like 80 degrees. So, of course, no, the thermostat
doesn't think that the house needs to be warm.
That's right.
So, the on switch, most of the time I don't recommend running the fan in the continuous mode because if it's moving a lot of room temperature air, let's say we're setting our house at 72 degrees. If the fan is moving 72 degree air, it can feel drafty. It's not warm air. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case where we have a warmer air source, a heated source that is not the furnace, we need to find some way of distributing it. You know, ideally, I'd like to see you put in like three fans over the top of the doors and turn the fans on and draw the air from one room to the other. But you know, since it's not really going to save you enough energy to pay for all those fans, it's kind of hard to say, oh, you have to do that. A more practical thing would be to say, okay, let's just turn on our circulating fan on our furnace system. And most of the construction we do these days, anything in the last 20 years or so, we have several return airs throughout the house, usually in every room. So therefore, it can suck some air or pull some air from the same room with the fireplace and help distribute it through the rest of the house. Yeah. Now, it's still going to feel a little drafty, so I wouldn't want to stand over the register while it's doing that, but at least it'll help even out the heat a little bit.
Very good. Next caller is in Aurora. Line four. Hello.
Hi. Yes, this is not my question, I spent quite a bit of time in hardware stores, and I've never seen that insulating tape that you were talking about earlier. What would I be looking for?
I have usually found it in the areas where they're selling the weather strip for windows and such. I've seen it used billed as an insulating repair tape for cracked windows. It's a relatively good adhesive, but it doesn't seem to pull off. When you pull the tape off, the adhesive stays on the tape and not on the glass or whatever material you have to put it on. I've run into it a couple places. I don't have a brand name to give out. That's something I'll try and see if I can't relocate and come up with a name. But at the moment, I don't have a name brand. My guess, of course, would be that it was made by 3M because they make just about everything adhesive. So it would be something that we could do a quick Google search or something for a 3M insulating tape or a glass repair tape that would probably do the job that we were looking for.
Because I have a door that I don't use in the wintertime, and I've put duct tape on it, but it does leave a residue on there. You know, it is a pain in the neck to deal with, so I've been looking for something that worked better.
Duct tape is good for about 2 to 4 weeks. After about 2 to 4 weeks, the glue hardens enough that when you pull the cloth backing off, the glue doesn't tend to stick with it as well.
Right.
So it leaves a residue. Masking tape is only good for about 1 to 2 weeks. Scotch tape, depending on what brand you get, can be anywhere from 1 week to about 3 months. So that's why I found, like I say, this insulating tape. It was a good, thick, clear plastic tape that was billed for patching over cracks and cracked window panes. A cracked window pane that has a piece of tape on it will insulate as well as a cracked window pane that, or a good window pane, as long as it's single glaze. Double glaze, of course, you lose the seal in between. But the insulating tape at that point in time that I found, and I used it for several years over a couple of windows and such. And since then, I've replaced windows, so I haven't need to look for it. So I don't remember the brand name for it.
Okay. Now, here's my question. At the end of last month's show, you had mentioned something about, you were talking to someone about foam insulation in a basement, that you would not recommend it. And what I had done several years ago, I had taken that foil-faced alumina, or, you know, the foam insulation, and I had cut sections of that and put it between the floor joist, between that top plate and the floor, the floor decking, or whatever you would call that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were to come in and inspect my house for a potential buyer, what would you say about that?
I would say that it is not proper to have an exposed foam insulation in a living space. The reason being, the foam, if there were to be a fire, the foam puts off very, very toxic fumes that could overcome you even before you knew that there was a fire in the house. The proper way of putting in foam insulation is to put the foam in and then cover it with a fire-resistant material such as drywall. So, yes, you can put the foam in there, but you're supposed to come back there and put a little piece of drywall over the top of it, which would give it a 15 or 20-minute fire protection so that we don't end up with the toxic fumes overcoming the folks in the house before the smoke and fire becomes an issue.
Now, I do not live in my basement. It's unfinished and never will be.
Yeah, well, strictly speaking, a basement is considered to be living space. In a crawl space, it's not a living space. There's nothing usually in a crawl space that will generate a fire, but a basement usually does have your water heater, your furnace, and you are quite likely to have a fire that would start in a basement. Of course, a fire runs right up to the floor joist and then goes across. So if you've got that insulation in the band joist, that's one of the first places that fire is or that heat is going to hit. So, yeah, ideally, anytime there is a foam insulation in the house, it's inside of what we'll call a living space. It is supposed to have a drywall covering.
Now, because at one time I thought about cutting fiberglass insulation, putting it up in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't like the idea of that fiberglass, you know, because I just think someday that's going to be a health issue we're going to be talking about. I don't know. But I didn't want to do that just because I just didn't think it was the best route to go. But would you think that would be a better route for people to go?
It is easier to put in the fiberglass because we don't have to cover it with the drywall because the fiberglass is not flammable. I gave the little snicker on your health issues in that I find it amusing that fiberglass, the fiber makeup of fiberglass, if you're examining it under a microscope, is very similar to that of asbestos. So, yes, I'm just waiting for the big fiberglass scare as soon as somebody gets tired of worrying about asbestos. Because, you know, we always have to have something newer, better, and greater to be worried about,
right,
whether it's a problem or not. So I would have to say that for most applications, I would recommend the fiberglass over the foam just because it's easier to install the fiberglass. We stuff it in there and forget about it, whereas the foam, we do have to have the fire-rated material over the top of it. Now, of course, ideally, what we try and do is not burn the house down, so it's not a problem.
Right. Now, well, I had one last thing then I'm going to ask you before I let you go to other callers. There's still room up there that I could probably take and put like 3.5-inch bat of fiberglass insulation and still could encapsulate that foam. Would that be something that you would recommend?
Well, I can't say no, but I can't say yes.
Oh, okay.
The fiberglass is not considered a fire-rated material. In other words, it doesn't block fire. Does it? Yes, it probably does. Is it rated to do so? No, it's not. So therefore, as an inspector and as your radio personality, I cannot say, yes, you can do it that way.
But as if you were going to come in and inspect my home, you're not going to be tearing down that insulation to see what's behind it either.
Most likely I will not be removing the fiberglass insulation. It'll be looking behind it.
Okay.
I will say if you're going to put fiberglass up there, to use an unfaced fiberglass, not one of the paper-backed fiberglasses. We don't want a vapor barrier up there. We want to be able to have that band joist area breathe. Since it is one of the areas that does get cold in the house, we don't want to get condensation behind there that could become trapped and get mold and mildew issues.
So you're telling me that foil-faced insulation I put up in there can be holding moisture up in there then, huh?
Generally, the foil-faced stuff is is the foil is perforated and they have some small holes through there. Most of the time that is used as a sheathing and is not considered a vapor barrier. Most of the types.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Right. Very good. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. And if you have a question, call us 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I had a question about furnace returns, air returns.
Mm-hmm.
I have a two-story house with two bedrooms and a small bathroom upstairs. And there are three furnace vents in the ceiling, but only one return upstairs, and it's only in one room. Should that be remedied, or is it something to remedy?
Well, does the house heat relatively well at this point?
Well, the furnace works very well. It's pretty... it seems to heat okay.
Okay. Well, the purpose of having multiple returns is to help ensure proper airflow to all corners of the house. What has happened is as we make our houses tighter and tighter and we go close the bedroom door and the carpet is high enough, it's at the bottom of the door, and we start pushing air to that room, if we don't have a good way of getting air back out of it, it tends to raise the pressure enough that most of our heat wants to go to other rooms, so you end up with cold rooms. So if you close doors, and if the type of person likes to close doors on all your bedrooms in the evenings and such, and all of a sudden the bedroom doesn't heat as well, then yes, we need a return air run to that area. However, if you're getting relatively even heating of the house, then the return air system seems to be doing its job.
Any impact on cooling in the summer?
Again, if you've got rooms that don't cool when they're closed up, then yes, that could be an issue. Another thing you can do is cut a half an inch off the bottom of the door so that it clears the carpet a little better and lets a little bit more air through. The furnace can't blow the house up like a balloon. Obviously, it pulls air from the house and blows air to the house, so it's not changing anything. But if you've got a room that's relatively tight and the furnace is trying to move air through it, of course, the air is going to take the path of least restriction. And so if it's pressurizing a room ever so slightly, then more heat or cooled air is going to go to other areas of the house.
Great.
So the return air is designed to help keep the pressure equalized. And as long as the return air system is working well, the rooms aren't completely tight, it shouldn't be a problem. If this house hasn't got one or two rooms that are just freezing every time you close the door, then I probably wouldn't change anything.
Just it's something I was thinking about. We had a couple of questions from people who had doors, and I'm assuming that maybe there were doors out to a patio or doors out to a porch or doors out to the outside or whatever that they wanted to insulate around the door for the wintertime just to deal with any cold air leaks around the door. So we were talking about that. It makes me think about those people who put plastic over their windows on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And there are kits that are available just, you know, specifically for that purpose. It's not really, not terribly hard. And a lot of people, that's just something that they do in the wintertime. And I guess I wonder, is that really worth that trouble? And will that, you know, how much will that add to your comfort and cut down on cold air infiltration by doing that?
And that's all going to depend on the quality of the windows that you've got and the amount of air leakage that the house has. If you've got older windows, I know in the home I have right now has aluminum framed windows, and aluminum framed windows do tend to transfer a lot of heat. I put the plastic on there, and it was a noticeable difference.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a double hung wood window, if it's installed right and seems to have some insulation around it, it probably isn't going to change as much. They also make the kits for those same plastic kits you're referring to for sliding glass doors. And I've seen those installed. And on windy days, that thing blows up like a balloon and hits up against the curtains. And I'm saying, wow. But the sliding glass door, because of the seal, was not actually letting much air in. So then I had to stop and think, well, okay, if it's blowing up like a balloon, that means there's other air leakage going out of the house that's actually trying to draw air from there. So the house had other air leaks. So that wasn't necessarily the place that we were losing all of our heat. Mm-hmm. It was where water air was coming in. But there is other areas in the house where we're losing heat. So is that, you know, they do help a lot in what I call our perceived comfort level. Your body acts like a radiant heater. If you stand next to a cold surface, you feel cold whether the room is cold or not. So if you've got a window that's a little drafty, you put this plastic covering over the top of it, you don't have the cold air coming off the window. whether or not there's air coming in or not, you don't feel the cold air, the fact that the glass is cool. So you walk past it and you don't feel cold. So you may be more comfortable in the room at even a lower temperature. So that saves you energy, whether it's airflow or not. It's saving you energy because of the perceived comfort level.
Yeah. Okay. Champagne, another caller here. Line one. Hello.
Hello there. I'd like to return to the air return question there. I've got a, well, it's a ranch house with a basement that you walk out of the basement because it's all on a hill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we're trying to keep the cool air and the warm air in the upper level. And so we have closed off all the registers downstairs and the air return. Did we do okay with that? Or you know, sometimes in the summertime, you know, it doesn't cool nearly as much upstairs as it is downstairs. But I thought part of that was because downstairs is pretty much buried in the ground and just keeping cool that way.
Right. The of course, cold air falls down anyway. So your cold air does want to go to your first level, your lowest level. And hot air will rise, and it will try and run up to the upper levels. So generally speaking, a lower level will be a little bit cooler, and we do try and circulate the air. I would not want to close down the return airs as much as you could do some balancing with the supply airs. The return air, we need to be able to make sure we're getting enough air to the furnace, to actually furnace or air conditioner to actually cool properly. They're a heat transfer or cool transfer item where they can only transfer the amount of heat or cool air that is blown through them. So if you start restricting the amount of air that can get through them, then it tends to reduce the efficiency of the furnace. So you're not necessarily helping your cause. You're starting to raise your bills without ever getting any additional service from it. Let's see.
So we should open up the air return.
I would probably keep the air returns, among other things. If it's cooler air down there for the summertime, we draw that cool air in. It's less of a load that the coil has to bear. In other words, it's less hot air going across the coil, so we actually get a little bit colder air coming up upstairs.
Okay. All right. So, well, that's good information. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. And I guess people also need to bear in mind that when you think about regulating the airflow, probably the first thing people think about is the register that's in the room, which you can either open or close. But they should also check to see, are there dampers in their ducts down probably near where they come out of the furnace, which is another place that you can control how much air is going on there, and that's going to do a lot more in terms of directing hot air or cold air to the places that you want, or not having it not go to the places that you don't want.
Right. We have what we call a little system for balancing the heating and cooling system, and actually a brochure that the University of Small Homes Council, Building Research Council, put out. And it does describe how to go around the house with a few thermometers and get 5 or 6 thermometers that all read close. The easiest thing is to put them all in one space and see if they're all reading the same. If one of them's high or low, you can put a plus or minus on it so you know how it compares to the other ones. We don't really care what the temperature is. We just want them all to be even. And then distribute them around through the house. And the heating season, you find the rooms that are actually the warmest and start closing those down till the other rooms come up to the same temperature. That way, when you walk through the house from one section to another, you don't suddenly get a chill or suddenly get warm. You don't have to keep taking your sweater on or off. You don't keep wanting to run over the thermostat and bounce it up and down. The thermostat would like to be set at a fairly constant temperature. So as long as we can balance the heating system with either the ductwork, and a lot of the ductwork does have a damper system. Some of them only have one or two for the main trunk lines. Others will have dampers on each individual runs. Some of them have no dampers, and we have to do all the control with the vanes on the registers. Mm. But balancing that heating and cooling system will help the comfort level of the house. If you've got a house where, you know, in one room you're perfectly comfortable, you walk to the next room and it's 4 or 5 degrees warmer or cooler, you don't want to go back there and bump the thermostat because then the comfortable room changes. So what you want to do is adjust the airflow to where all the rooms become comfortable.
Yeah. One other thing here, maybe we've got about a minute or two left. We are now at the point where maybe people are not thinking about that much about their gutters. They're thinking about other stuff. but it's, you know, and now, particularly now that where we've had a lot of leaf drop, and maybe most, you know, depending on what your yard looks like and what kind of trees you got. It might be a good time to think about either if you do it yourself, do it, or if you got somebody to do it for you, get somebody to come clean out your gutters.
Well, this rain and weather that we had over the weekend has cleared most of the trees, I was noticing. So, yes, that is when the gutters are going to block up. So if we get it done now before we get a lot of freezing rain, it helps reduce ice damming and all sorts of water problems later down the road. So, yes, gutters, of course, every time we have a season change, that's one of the things we need to look at. But right after this wind and rain that we had over the weekend, I know I walked out of mine and went, huh, time to get the ladder out when I get done with the radio program. So that's my afternoon project. Drive by and see me standing on the roof, you'll know why.
You're cleaning out the gutters. Any last thing in particular that you would just suggest that people be thinking about?
Well, again, with the weather change and getting a little bit warmer, we want to check things like furnace filters. Depending on the filter you've got, you may need to change it as often as every 1 or 2 months. Most of them will go 3 months or so. The high-efficiency ones can actually go a little bit longer than that. But in order to get your furnace system at peak performance, it needs to be able to move air. And if you've got a dirty filter, it doesn't move air well. So that 80% efficient furnace or 90% efficient furnace you've got may not be 90 or 80% if it's not getting enough airflow through it. So a clean filter is something you want to check. And they're usually inexpensive homeowner-type thing.
Yeah, and that's something that it should be easy to do. And just even if you think it should be okay, you might want to take a look at it. Because when you get it and it's new, it's white. When you pull it out, if it's gray, you might think, well, maybe that would be a good time to change it.
I don't know. Mine's blue, but anyway.
Blue. Oh, okay. When it starts. All right. Well, the ones that I use, they're white when they're new. And we have a gray cat, so you can definitely tell the time to change it. Because
if you have pets,
start looking like the cat.
Yeah, when you have pets, it's obviously a sign that you probably ought to change the filter a little bit more often.
All right. Well, there, for this time around, we'll leave it. With our thanks to Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is here on the program once a month. It's always on a Monday to take these questions. Thanks very much.
All right. Well, thank you.